We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
The Securities and Exchange Commission is one of the country's leading financial watchdogs. But when it came to watching Bernie Madoff, the commission has admitted what most people already suspected. It should have caught the Ponzi scheme years ago. A new report by the SEC's Inspector General says the agency missed glaring evidence that Madoff was cheating investors. NPR's Robert Smith reports.
Part of the myth of Bernie Madoff is that he was so smooth, so talented, that no one suspected he was committing the largest fraud in history. The Inspector General's report destroys that illusion. The SEC started receiving tips in 1992 that Madoff was a big liar. One complaint to the agency in 2005 was entitled, "The World's Largest Hedge Fund is a Fraud." Another informant told the SEC that he was so worried he was withdrawing all his money from Madoff. But the new report says that the agency was colorblind to these red flags. Five times the SEC sent in an investigative team. Five times they missed the big picture. The IG's report says that even when they caught Bernard Madoff in contradictions and inconsistencies, they just asked the man about them, and he weaseled his way out. The investigator general, H. David Kotz, did not fully explain why the agency bungled the investigations, but he did note that the SEC teams were inexperienced. Still, the report concludes that though the SEC was incompetent in this case, it wasn't criminal. Kotz found no evidence that Madoff had collaborated with anyone at the agency, although the SEC may have made the crime worse. Madoff used to brag to nervous investors that he had been examined by the SEC, and they found nothing wrong. Robert Smith, NPR News, New York.
It's 2:45. Well, here we are in the first week of September, and the season is waning for some fresh farmers market foods. But there are always some year-round staples at the Montgomery Farm Women's Cooperative, a 50-year-old institution in Bethesda, Maryland. Recently in line at that market was NPR's Marissa Penaloza.
The lines here get long, so long that customers queue up along the rope line.
My name is Bertrand Houllier. I'm French.
He bakes pastries.
This one is a croissant and chocolate croissant. It's with a special butter called Charon butter, mini croissant, regular croissant.
Houllier is a classic Frenchman.
I bring almost all the ingredients from France. French butter, French flour. I bake all my bread on a stone oven. And so this is a kind of oven you don't find here. This is why I bring my oven from France.
Not only does Houllier's stand look like any patisserie, with baskets full of perfectly arranged pastries, but
they taste like I'm in France. I mean, I feel like I'm transported. It's much cheaper than a flight. And they're just delicious. They melt in your mouth. My name is Nolmini Rubin. I come every week, every Friday. And I have to come early because sometimes he runs out.
Unlike many of the farmers here, Juliet doesn't have to worry about seasons. He can bake all year round. But his pastries are baked and sold the same day. So he worries about quantity, how much to bake each day.
Every night I check on the weather forecast. You know, I go to a website so I know if it's raining, not raining, windy, snowy, you know. When there is a beautiful sun, I make a lot because I know people will come.
On this sunny morning, the line is constant. A mix of loyal customers and first-timers. People wait patiently.
Hi, good morning. How are you today?
I made it.
Julia is confident but warm. He greets customers with the familiarity of people who know each other. His baskets are emptying quickly.
Two croissants in another bag.
Julia says the market reminds him of home.
In France, we have a lot of market. We have a lot of small store, you know. Here, it's always supermarket or superstore. And so when I see there is a market here, I come to see. I like, you know, the ambiance. We say ambiance in French. The ambiance is, you know, it's more convivial, more friendly here.
And, he says, he makes good money. Marisa Peñalosa, NPR News.
If you or someone you know is visually or print impaired, stop by the WILL booth at the Farmers Market at Lincoln Square Village, Urbana, from 8 a.m. to 12 noon and get a receiver from the Illinois Radio Reader. The Radio Reader is a service of Illinois Public Media that provides the reading of local newspapers, magazines, and much more to the visually impaired in our area. Quantities are limited, so make sure you stop by on Saturday, September the 5th from 8 to noon.
It's 2:48. This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. In this portion of the program, we're going to take a look at a family farm in central Illinois. My guest is a member of that family. Her name is Tara Brockman. She tells the story about life on the farm through the seasons in the new book, The Seasons on Henry's Farm, A Year of Food and Life on a Sustainable Farm. Henry is Tara's brother. In her introduction, Tara Brockman says this about the farm. It's the place where I grew up and the place I couldn't wait to leave. But after roaming the world for a time, she felt a need to go home. The book is a memoir of 52 weeks, 1 year on the farm. It contains family history, photos, and recipes. It's also a reflection on some big issues, including ecology, economy, politics, and more. My guest this afternoon, Tara Brockman. Tara, I'm happy to have you on the program with me this afternoon. Hello.
Hello. I'm happy to be here.
So when did you leave the farm and where did you go?
You know, I went to the West Coast, to California and Oregon. I then, after a while, ended up in Japan for 5 years, in 1985 to 90, and then New York City for about 10 years.
And so when did you return home to Illinois?
You know, around 1999, I had a job in the Chicago area, and then about a year after that, I gradually made my way back down to the farm.
Yeah. So then what inspired you to write this book of essays and recipes?
You know, it wasn't exactly inspiration, maybe like a lot of things on the farm, it's perspiration, but the thing was, I was writing every week anyway for my brother because I'm writing weekly notes for his customers in Evanston and for folks at his CSA in Bloomington. And so every week I would write anyway and let people know what's happening on the farm, what's coming up to market. And then I realized that people really appreciated that and really wanted to connect with the people and the work that was being done to bring them that food.
Yeah. Would you describe Henry's farm for us?
It's extremely diverse. Latest count, around 650 varieties of vegetables. And if that's hard for people to have a concept of it, you can kind of break it down and say there's, you know, 35 kinds of lettuces and 26 kinds of potatoes and probably 100 different vegetables. But then within those 100, you know, many dozens of each kind. So it's really quite beautiful. Hidden away, people who have the sense that Illinois is flat and stretches on forever. It does in some places, but we're in the Mackinac River Valley between Peoria and Bloomington, where there are hills and valleys and trees. And so he's tucked away in some bottom land, and a small stream runs through it, and surrounded by oak hickory forest and, you know, all the wonderful birds and insects and whatnot that you see in Illinois.
Sounds wonderful. When and how was it decided that the family would buck what, for a lack of a better term, I'll call the agribusiness model of farming?
You know, it's interesting. It kind of skipped a generation, maybe, with you know, my great-grandparents and grandparents. Actually, the farm I'm on right now is my great-grandparents' farm visiting my sister who lives here. And it's just actually Interstate 57 cut right through my grandparents' farm. But it's you know, they were a diverse farm that had you know, wheat, oats, corn, soybeans, hay, and horses, cows, sheep and pigs, and turkeys and ducks and chickens. You know, just like I think a lot of folks remember. And they went through the changes to sort of a more monocropped and vertical-based agriculture in the 60s and 70s, and you know, so my dad grew up on a farm like that and had that in his mind, although he went and, as they said in those days, got an education and became a college professor. But I think in his mind that was always, you know, ecologically speaking and financially for a farm not to put all their eggs in one basket was a good way to do things. And so that's how we grew up in my family, my brother and I and my other sisters and brother. Had this idea that a farm was diverse and it was hard work and you did eat what you grew. And you know, we all went away and did other things around the world, Henry included, and then gradually made our way back to what just seemed to make sense.
Mm. Here at the outset of September, what is the work at hand?
Yeah, you know, this is a really busy time of year because the summer crops are peaking and the fall crops are coming on, so you're kind of doing double duty. So we probably just passed the peak of the tomatoes. We're maybe right around the peak of all the melons, the watermelons, the muskmelons. We're also getting, I mean, literally, I think last week he did bring tons of tomatoes up to the market, like 2,000 pounds. And what do we have? Oh, all the eggplants are amazing right now, the green peppers, the colored peppers, all the things of summer, even though we didn't have a hot summer, they're still doing okay. Plus, a lot of his fall crops are coming on, again, the salad greens, the mizuna, the arugula, some of the chine greens. So we're getting back into the fall green season.
Yeah. When does he get a day off in the coming weeks or months?
You know, Sunday is pretty much the day of rest. He does, you know, try to rest up a little bit and do some of the desk work and housework and other things. And then really he doesn't get a rest till after the last, there's a pre-Thanksgiving market, and his last CSA is the Tuesday before Thanksgiving. So we do sort of give thanks after
wow.
the hard frost comes.
Wow.
And then there's a lot of things after Thanksgiving. I mean, it's all the cleanup and the repair and the tools and the machinery and the boxes. He has to make more wooden boxes. You know, so many of them fall apart during the year. So there's a lot to do, but at least he gets to do it more in a relaxed way around the house and be with his family a little more.
Yeah. Is there any one time of year you enjoy most on the farm?
Probably the fall. I don't know. It's always been the time of year that when the first cool breezes and the blue skies come, and I feel energized all over again. And something about knowing winter is coming, it makes every day more precious.
Yeah. Speaking of that, getting ready for winter, maybe you would tell us how you like to preserve tomatoes for wintertime use.
You know, the easiest thing these days I encourage all of our market customers or anybody to do is chunk them up into a Ziploc plastic bag and put them in the freezer. You know, you can do the other old-fashioned canning if you like to, but when we're so busy at this time of year, and we get all the reject tomatoes, the ones that are a little soft or have a little bug damage or something, and just take out the bad part and chunk up the rest of it into, you know, medium-sized chunks and throw them in a freezer bag. And that's so easy, and you can get gallons and gallons of tomatoes in freezer bags in quick time. And then whenever you're ready for it, make soup, make sauce, make, you know, pizza sauce or whatever you want with them.
Pull them out in January.
Yeah.
Yeah. Tara, thank you so much for talking with me. I know we're going to talk down the line for a longer period of time, and I really look forward to that.
And can you encourage people to come to the Urbana Farmers Market on Saturday?
I was just about to do that.
Thank you.
Tara Brockman will be at the market at the square in downtown Urbana this Saturday to meet and talk with market goers and sign copies of her book. And the market, by the way, begins at 7 a.m. and runs until noon. Tara, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Tara Brockman is the author of The Seasons on Henry's Farm, A Year of Food and Life on a Sustainable Farm. The book is published by Surrey Books.
Earth and Sky.
According to a 2009 report released by the University of Pennsylvania, a shortage of math and science teachers in the United States might be driven by the dissatisfaction of teachers already on the job. Many don't stay on.
These secondary science teachers have the best options outside of school for employment. They're very competent in the laboratory. They know basic science, and they are welcome in the private sector and in government agencies.
That's Sheila Tobias. She co-authored a recent book, Science Teaching as a Profession, Why It Isn't, How It Can Be. She also conducted an online survey of science teachers, and she found that their job dissatisfaction was rooted in a lack of autonomy and control.
Over what they can teach, at what pace they can teach, what exams they can use, and professional prestige.
A 2006 study by the National Academies found the U.S. to be declining in science and technology competitiveness with other nations. Tobias added that science teachers are nervous about the current method of science instruction in the United States.
They believe that science just doesn't lend itself to single right answers, and they are very fearful that any kind of paper and pencil bubble type test is going to punish the very students we're trying to encourage to stay in science.
Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Common Ground Food Co-op in Lincoln's